Chapter 16. Just sit down, said Ben. You're doing my head in. Steph, arms folded, continued to pace, only pausing for a nervous drag on the last embers of her cigar.
Sorry, but sometimes little things make me nervous, said Steph. You know, like finding out your supposedly secret hideout isn't so secret.
It's not that... Please don't insult my intelligence by telling me it's not that bad. How about...
No, Ben. We've never had it worse than this. We've never even come close to being worse than this.
Steph pointed at the monitor and the several figures making their way into the record shop across the street. The shop, which was also owned by Ben, housed their underground emergency exit.
Samford's with them, said Steph. Now why am I not surprised?
Ben hired Samford to run the record shop after he had approached Ben after getting out of prison. Knowing how hard it was to get work on the outside, Ben had taken a chance on him. He figured he could keep Samford away from their real operation. He was wrong.
Thanks to your prison buddy, Clancy and his men will be here in less than 10 minutes, so forgive me if I'm a little stressed.
Take it easy, Steph, I have a plan.
Which is?
Ben went silent.
You don't really have a plan, do you?
No.
Give me one reason why I don't kick your ass into next year.
My award-winning personality? Steph shot him an angry glance before moving to one of the walls. Touching the hidden pressure pad, she stepped back as a section of the wall slid away to reveal an assortment of weapons and equipment.
I'm assuming you're going to do something really stupid when they get here?
Asked Steph, lifting a weapon from the compartment.
I was thinking more insanely clever.
Really, really stupid, then, said Steph. I'll see if I can slim the odds down a bit. I would tell you to be careful, but I'd be wasting my breath, wouldn't I? The last time I wasn't ready for them. This time Clancy and his boys are about to find out what it means to get on my bad side. I'm sure they're quaking in their boots. Thanks for the confidence boost.
No problem. Besides, you still owe me my cut for this job, and if we live through this, I expect a bonus, otherwise mercenaries will be the least of your problems.
Ben began quietly counting to himself.
What are you doing now?
Figuring out what day of the month it is. You're only usually this cranky when... Steph threw the safety off the MP5 submachine gun she was holding.
Don't start with me, Ashodi.
A glaring truth became apparent to Samford the moment he unlocked the door and allowed the figures clad in black to move past him. He was a traitor, one that had been years in the making. He had been approached a few months after he left prison by associates of an anonymous and wealthy benefactor. All Samford had to do was approach Ben, get close, sit tight, watch and wait for when he was needed. Over the years, he all but forgot about the arrangement. Last night's phone call changed all that. They were offering a clean slate for all his gambling debts he owed, both before and after prison, and some nice change in the tune of 10 grand for a few minutes' work. Samford wished he was the kind of man who would not sell out a friend, but it was no use. Any outdated notions of doing the right thing were overshadowed by his desire for self-preservation and wealth, which were far greater motivators than friendship and loyalty. He felt two taps on his shoulder. It was the leader. He was pointing at Samford's torch. Taking the hint, Samford switched it off. Moving to the head of the group, Samford led them past the many cluttered shelves of junk, through another door, which took them into a storeroom. It was a cramped fit for everyone, but they somehow managed it. The only light on offer was from a small window high up on the wall that faced the storeroom entrance. On the floor in the centre of the room was a flat, square-shaped metal hatch. No turning back now, Samford told himself. Considering the amount of cash they had paid him over the last year for just keeping an eye on Ben, he was sure they could not be doing anything 100% legal. Looking into the expressions surrounding him, each one illuminated by the streaks of moonlight crisscrossing the room, he was even more sure.
We're here, the leader whispered. Now what?
What about my cash? Surprised at his own bravery, or rather his stupidity in the face of so many loaded weapons. You said I'd get it up front. The leader smiled, and Samford felt like someone had reached into his trousers and grabbed his testicles.
Don't worry, you'll get your payment.
Samford did not like the way the man was cradling the gun in his arms. But if you need some incentive... He gestured with his eyes to something behind Samford. Following the leader's direction, Samford saw a metallic briefcase lying on the ground. The case was secured by two combination locks on either side of the handle. Tell us what we need to know to breach Ashodi's security measures, and I'll give you the combination to the briefcase right now.
What, and you'll just let me walk out of here? Said Samford, unconvinced. Man, you must think I'm crazy.
The leader stepped forward until he was inches from Samford's face.
We're not cheap thugs, Mr. Brown. We are professionals. The question is, are you?
Samford considered his alternatives. It did not take him long to realize there were none. He had backed himself into a corner. Nothing to do now except play out the hand. He walked up to the hatch, knelt down in front of it, and took out a small knife. With the others looking on, he tapped out a sequence of sounds onto the surface of the panel with the knife before sitting back. The hatch slid back, revealing steps leading down into the darkness.
"Head down the stairs. They'll lead you into a tunnel," explained Samford. "At the end is a wall. There must be a way past it, because I've seen Ben and Steph go in and out of there loads of times."
"Security measures?"
"I told you before, I don't know if he's got any. I don't even know what he's into. I don't want to."
Samford caught the shocked look on the man standing closest to the leader. Obviously it was news to him.
"So we could have already tipped him off just by opening this thing. Great. That's just great," said one of the men.
"There's nowhere for him to go. We got a sniper watching the record shop entrance," said the leader. "There are only two of them, and the only one with any kind of military training is the woman. So we put her down first."
The leader turned to Samford, providing him with an assuring smile.
"Well, Mr. Brown, as promised."
Even as he spoke, Samford was already scrabbling across the storeroom to the attaché case, his thumbs resting on the tumblers of the case's two combination locks.
"The left combination is 3, 2, 4, and the right is 7, 1, 9. Enjoy your reward, Mr. Brown. You've earned it."
The leader started down the steps, his men following. Samford did not hear or see them go. All his attention was focused on the attaché case. After fumbling with the combinations, the clasps on the case finally sprang open. Licking his lips in anticipation, he carefully opened the case. He wanted to ensure not $1 bill escaped.
"What the—"
The interior of the case was empty except for a small piece of paper neatly folded in two.
"It's a check," said Samford, trying to convince himself. "It has to be a check."
He opened the paper and read the single phrase written in large black ink. "We don't like traitors." Samford turned too late to see the leader, who had obviously sneaked back up the stairs while he had been focused on the case.
"Why?"
said Samford, tears already beginning to fall as he watched the man fit a silencer to the Beretta he was holding.
"Can't you read?" he replied, firing a single round into Samford's forehead.
Samford fell backwards, one hand still clutching the attaché case, the other the now blood-stained message.
"Unlock the door, Jason," said Luther, keeping his tone light. "You're in shock. You need help."
Luther glanced at Napoleon, hoping he took the hint.
"You know me, Jason," said Napoleon, his tone matching Luther's. "He's right. You have to open the door. Those people you heard, they're coming to help you."
Jason shook his head.
"No, you're wrong. They're coming to kill us."
Luther knew enough about the effects of shock to know that the best way to deal with it was to be as gentle and compassionate as possible. The heavy-booted footsteps coming up the corridor outside were not helping the situation. If he pushed too hard, Jason's mind could close in on itself, and he could kiss goodbye to getting anything useful out of him for a very long time.
"Listen, son."
"I'm not your son,"
Jason shot back, glaring at him.
"I don't have a father anymore, remember? He's dead. They're both dead."
Luther started towards Jason one cautious step at a time. He held his hands out in front of him, showing he was no threat. The sudden banging on the door caused him to freeze.
"Stand fast," ordered Luther. "We have a small situation here."
There was no reply, and the banging increased. Now it was Luther's turn to experience a feeling of uneasiness.
"I hate to say this," whispered Napoleon, pulling his Colt 45 from its side holster, "but I think Jason may have a point."
"Come off it. How can he be—"
Luther then heard something that demanded immediate action. He sprang forward, tackling Jason. Napoleon was already halfway over the desk as Luther moved. With Jason struggling to break Luther's grip, they tumbled into a book cabinet. The next thing they heard was a sound not unlike a shower of hailstones, only softer. All through the room, pieces of wood were catapulted through the air like tiny darts as the furniture was hit. Luther saw Napoleon dip his head behind an oak desk, as it too was riddled with suppressed gunfire. Luther shelved the notion that his backup team were trying to kill him, and allowed the cold and rational part of his psyche to take hold.
"Stone!"
he called out, while shoving Jason back further into the corner.
"Stone, you hit?"
Luther saw a hand appear from behind the desk, the fingers forming an OK sign. Then there were four fingers held aloft.
"Stay down," he told Jason.
Luther edged closer to the door, ignoring a splinter as it struck his left cheek, drawing blood. He focused on the four fingers. Three fingers now. Luther took the safety off his gun. Two fingers. He took a deep, cleansing breath. One finger. Then a single clenched fist. Napoleon's other hand appeared over the top of the desk, clutching his Colt. It roared into life, blasting large chunks out of the barricaded door. Luther twisted his arm so that he was able to fire into the door without exposing himself.
"The window!"
shouted Jason. Napoleon swung round to see two sets of boots appear at the window. He threw himself sideways, dodging gunfire that nearly ripped the desk in two. Colliding into a bookcase, Napoleon was stunned but managed to return fire. One of the men was blasted from his feet and fell screaming from the window. The second man dropped into the room, firing. Napoleon was covered by paper as the row of books above his head were reduced to confetti by gunfire. Unlike the aim of his attacker, Napoleon's aim was accurate and unhampered by panic. A shot rang out, removing the attacker's right knee. The man fell, his automatic rifle flying out of his hands and towards Luther. The door burst open, and three men entered the room. Discarding his gun, Luther ran forward, caught the rifle, turned, and fired. The result was bloody but conclusive. Another four men appeared at the doorway, stepping over the bodies of the fallen, their weapons trained on Luther.
"Down!"
Luther dropped as Napoleon, a gun in each hand, dived over him, firing. One man was killed instantly, the others scattered.
"Jason, the door!" shouted Napoleon.
Jason kicked the door shut.
"Help me!"
ordered Napoleon, who was beginning to drag a desk. Luther came over and together they shoved it against the door. Luther saw the wounded man was crawling towards a gun. He was about to shout a warning when Napoleon fired once. The man did not move a second time.
"You didn't have to kill him," said a horrified Luther. "You could have fired a warning shot."
"He had his warning shot," said Napoleon. "He chose to ignore it." Luther would have to watch Napoleon carefully. This was not a man to be crossed lightly.
"Jason," called out Napoleon. "You okay?"
"No."
"Just stay calm and keep your head down," Napoleon told him.
Napoleon bent over one of the corpses and tore open the man's sleeve.
"What's that?"
Luther pointed at an intricate tattoo, which decorated the inner part of the man's right bicep just below his armpit.
"I've seen it before," said Jason.
Napoleon grabbed Jason's arms.
"Where?"
"In my nightmares,"
said Jason, who was staring at the tattoo of the flaming sword and the orange bird.
"But I didn't think it actually existed. What is it?"
"A coat of arms," sighed Napoleon, letting go of Jason.
"A coat of arms?" repeated Luther.
"The Knights of Cadmus," said Napoleon. "If you thought we were in trouble before, you can multiply that by 100 now." Luther had been in more than his fair share of scrapes and near-death situations. He was not about to be spooked by a tattoo and a cryptic warning.
"Who are we dealing with?"
"Fanatics," said Napoleon. "They'll keep coming. It won't matter how many of them we kill. Death holds no terror for them." To add weight to his words, sounds could be heard of something being slammed repeatedly against the door. Luther did not know how many men were on the other side of the door, but there were too many for the two of them and a terrified teenager to handle. He flipped the catch, allowing the ammo clip to slide out into his waiting palm. 6 rounds. Not enough. Not nearly enough.
"All we want is the boy," a voice shouted. "Give us Jason Chen and the two of you can go free. Stand against us and die."
"Original," said Napoleon.
"I've got 6 shots,"
Luther pointed at Napoleon's shotgun.
"How many you got in there?"
Napoleon slid his arm over his shoulder and pulled the shotgun from its holster. "Enough to get us out of here," he said, moving to the wall that was facing them. "Be ready to move," Napoleon told them, closing his eyes. Luther frowned.
"Get ready for what, Stone? Stone!"
A moment later, everything changed again for Luther. Like the creature he had fought earlier, this was another of those "my life will never be the same" moments. His half-formed suppositions about Professor Stone were thrown into disarray. He gazed, struck dumb at the luminous glow now surrounding the shotgun Napoleon held. The eerie yellowish light suffused the room in an extraordinary hue, as if it was trapped inside a glass jar with a million fireflies. Even stranger than the light was the energy that defied description emanating out of Napoleon's chest and down his right arm. A thin layer of sweat had formed on the professor's brow. His eyes remained tightly shut. Whatever Napoleon was attempting, it was clear to Luther that it was taking its toll on him. Napoleon knew the risk he was taking using his power again so soon after the battle with Alvareth. His mind and body needed time to recharge from the mental and physical strain placed upon him every time he called forth the power. He could already feel his pulse and heartbeat quickening beyond acceptable levels. There were others who shared his strange vocation, others who had died attempting a similar feat. There was no choice, Napoleon told himself. All he could do now was steel himself for what was to come. Napoleon heard another crash against the door and guessed one more would be enough for the door to give way.
Stone! Yelled Luther. If you're going to do something, now's the time!
Luther's words had the desired effect. Napoleon raised his shotgun and aimed it at the solid wall in front of him. His heart was bursting against his chest. The blood raced through his veins. Focus, breathe, find the quiet place, the place where anything is possible. Napoleon opened his eyes and spoke the word. He could not stop the others from hearing the word, but that didn't matter. Even if the torch agent spoke a dozen languages, he would never understand it. The surrounding energy was pulled into the shotgun, then discharged in one column of pure, focused energy. It tore through the wall, leaving a hole at least 7 feet high in its wake. The force of the blast knocked Jason off his feet. Luther stumbled, but somehow stayed upright. The energy did not disperse, but instead continued forward, blasting another hole in the far wall of the adjoining room, and causing the same damage to two more rooms before it eventually dissipated. It was then the office door finally gave way, allowing several men into the room. Napoleon was exhausted, but still was able to grab Jason by the scruff of his T-shirt and haul him over to the hole. He could barely lift his head, and his legs threatened to buckle at any second.
Go!
Ordered Luther, hoisting a man who was unfortunate enough to enter the room first off his feet and pitching him back into his comrades. Luther scooped up the attacker's weapon, and again the room was alive with gunfire. Drawing on what little strength remained, Napoleon shoved Jason into the next room, yelling at him to keep moving. Hearing the gunfire behind him, he thought about going back to help the torch agent. He knew he would be of little use. It was taking everything he had to keep himself from blacking out, let alone plunging into a second gun battle. He had to concentrate on getting Jason to safety and hoping the torch agent would not be far behind, or at the least, died quickly. The Knights of Cadmus utilized methods for gaining information that were far less humane than a bullet through the brain. As he entered the second room, the toll of his actions began exacting their due on him. His vision began to fail him, along with his legs. He sagged against a wall, where he tried unsuccessfully to rally his strength. Even the simplest bodily function had now become a lesson in willpower. Jason reached the last hole. He had not needed much prompting from Professor Stone to make a break for it. He recognized the deserted and darkened room now littered with dust and debris as one of the staff common rooms. Even through his fear, Jason wished he could be here when the teaching staff saw the remains of their room. Jason dismissed his first pleasant thought in ages and sprinted for the door that would lead to a small balcony and a flight of stairs, which would lead him downwards and out to the relative safety of the college grounds. Wasting no more time, he grabbed the door handle and with it, the promise of more safety than he had known in the last 30 minutes. He looked round, realizing for the first time he was completely alone. Reluctantly, he looked back through the holes and saw Luther embroiled in a brutal hand-to-hand battle with at least 6 other men. Clutching a rifle in his large hands, Luther had turned it from a sophisticated piece of weaponry into a makeshift but effective club. Jason then caught sight of Professor Stone, slumped on the ground, legs stretched out in front of him, clutching his chest. Napoleon looked up and saw Jason. Lifting his hand, he kept pointing to the door. Jason shared the sentiment. Right now, there was nothing more he would have liked than to follow his lecturer's advice. After one last look at the closed door, Jason took a deep breath and ran back towards Napoleon. "Bloody conscience," he mumbled as he ran.